Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Lexington was a racehorse who won 6 of his 7 race starts and became the most successful sire of the second half of the 19th century. While Lexington's life is well documented, the life of his black groom remains a mystery. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Geraldine Brooks takes a discarded painting, a skeleton in an attic, and the greatest racehorse in American history and weaves a story of spirit, obsession, and injustice across American history. Geraldine Brooks, so good to see you. Welcome back.
It's so great to be here, Mindy, and in person
and in
as
person.
Well.
I know. So while Lexington is sort of the star of the story, so to speak, it's also the story of the history of the black trainers, grooms, and jockeys who were mostly enslaved people. How did you come upon this idea for the story?
Well, initially it was all about the horse. I was at a lunch at Plymouth Plantation, and another guest at the lunch was an official from the Smithsonian, and he was regaling the table with the story of how he had just delivered a skeleton from the attic of the Natural History Museum in Washington to pride of place in a new exhibition at the International Museum of the Horse in Lexington, Kentucky. And as he talked about the extraordinary life story of this horse, I was completely transfixed because I'm a little horse crazy myself. But it was the twists and turns of the horse's story and what happened to the horse during the Civil War that sparked my passion. And then as I started to research in earnest, I learned about how integral to the success of this horse the black trainers and jockeys and grooms, the enslaved people on whose plundered labor this extraordinary industry of thoroughbred breeding and racing, which was huge in the 19th century, and it rested on their skills, so there was no way to tell the story and erase that history.
So we know Lexington existed. We know that there was the skeleton in the attic, which is also true. What about the painting?
So when I went to the Smithsonian to research the skeleton and the science around bones and what the Smithsonian actually does when they're using bones for scientific research, they took me to see a portrait of Lexington that had been painted by a very interesting artist of the 1850s. And this painting had come to the Smithsonian in a bequest from a remarkable woman named Martha Jackson, who was a gallerist in New York in the 1950s, and she was a pioneer in many ways, being a woman in the art world as a dealer. But she had a radical eye, and so she was one of Pollock's earliest supporters, and de Kooning, and Bridget Riley, and she's actually credited with coining the term op art. So she was right at the forefront of the avant-garde, and every other painting that she gave to the Smithsonian was a radical, edgy contemporary art piece, except for this one 19th century traditional oil painting of Lexington. I was intrigued about how that painting got into this modernist's collection.
Yeah. So you said you're quite a horsey. You have a horse.
I do have a lovely horse called Valentine.
Yeah. And Valentine is not your first horse.
Not my first horse.
I read you had this.
First rodeo.
A very spirited Palomino is what. And you didn't start riding until you were in your 50s, right?
That is right. This was my midlife crisis. You know, some guys go out and get a red Mustang. I went out and got a horse. But I became completely enthralled with having a relationship with a horse. My first horse, I hasten to say, it was too much horse for me, but she came to live on the Cape, and she and her new partner together won the teen division of the Connecticut Barrel Racing Championship. So she just wanted to go.
Yeah. Sorry, so Valentine, you use Valentine for some therapy riding?
So yes, we volunteered at Misty Meadows, which is a terrific therapeutic riding program on the vineyard. Mm-hmm. And kids with a range of different abilities and disabilities are able to have these wonderful experience riding. And I worked mostly with autistic kids, and it was astonishing to see how they would change when they're on that horse.
It's like magic, isn't it? I remember doing a story on, and this was in Tennessee, on therapeutic riding, and there was this little girl, and there were several kids there, but this little girl riding, and I thought, huh, I wonder what her disability is, because she seems so perfectly normal. And the mom said, oh, she has severe ADHD. She is bouncing off the walls, even into the car, until they turn into the barn. And then she gets on this horse, and it's like magic. Amazing. And I remember when I was a kid, my cousin had a horse, and this was one of those bucking horses, didn't want anybody riding it, right? But you put a kid on that horse, and it would just walk the perimeter of the fence and then bring the kid back. And, you know, it's like, it's just amazing.
They are incredibly intuitive animals. Mm-hmm. And it's an extraordinary relationship because, you know, you and I are both dog people, and I wouldn't be without a dog, but we and canines look out at the world straight ahead, eyes front, because we're predators. And so it's easier for us to form a bond because we're on the same side in the world, whereas a horse is a prey animal. Their eyes are scanning, you know, the perimeter all the time to see what's coming to eat them. Yeah. And so for a predator and a prey animal to form a bond of trust and love, it's really an extraordinary thing.
Sure is. And so the book begins with Theo, a doctoral candidate in art history, who pulls a painting of a horse out of a pile of trash. So tell us a little bit more about Theo.
So Theo is, I realized very quickly as I was writing this book that it was going to have a contemporary thread because I wanted to get into the science at the Smithsonian. I love doing that. I love researching extraordinary jobs that people do. And but once I had that 21st century strand to the book, I realized I couldn't leave the issue of race in the past, in the story of the enslaved black horseman, and pretend that the story of race is over and done with, because it isn't. And, you know, it was, I was writing with the jackhammer of the terrible events that we've had in the last few years, the Ahmaud Arbery and George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and all the names that we hear and that we don't remember, but there are just so many. And I just realized that it would be really wrong to pretend that this was an issue for the past and not the present. So Theo's character, you know, carries the story into present day Washington, D.C.
Next, we have Jess, who runs Smithsonian's osteology. I don't even know how to say prep lab. So give us a sense of Jess and the lab. This is fascinating.
So I got to go to the Museum Support Center in Maryland, which, if you call the Smithsonian the attic of America, this is the attic's attic. So 90% of what the Smithsonian has is stored there, and scientific research of all kinds. It's got the DNA record of every known species on Earth. It's got specimens dating, you know, back to the 19th century and early collections. It's got things from Teddy Roosevelt's expeditions, and labs, high-tech, very state-of-the-art labs for evaluating paintings or doing scientific research on bones. And it was just wonderful to spend time there because you're in a lab and through the glass window on the door, you see these extraordinary things going by on trolleys. Like a Triceratops head will be going one way and a Dutch master's painting will be coming the other way. It's just an extraordinary place. And the osteology prep lab is this state-of-the-art, every kind of scientific instrument you could think of. But the real work of cleaning the bones is still done by bugs.
Yeah. I had not heard that before, but it makes sense. So they're like, it's a sort of a beetle?
Yeah, it's a domestic beetle, and they just, we haven't been able to come up with a better way of cleaning bones that doesn't destroy the material and so retains all the scientific information that are in the bones. Mm. So it's a very funky place.
Yeah, wow. So you want to read a little bit about Jess?
I will read a little bit about Jess. And I should just say, you know, there were so many characters whose lives were very unfamiliar to me. So I decided to do myself a solid. And she's a nerdy Australian kid, as I was growing up in the western suburbs of Sydney. So I've taken a lot of myself and put in it Jess. In Jess. Jess, Smithsonian Museum Support Center, Maryland, 2019. Jess was 7 when she dug up the dog. He'd been dead a year. She and her mum had buried him with ceremony under the flowering red gum in the backyard, and they'd both cried. Her mother wanted to cry again when Jess requested a large Tupperware container for the bones she'd just exhumed. Generally, Jess's mother was the kind of parent who would let her daughter set the house on fire if she thought it could teach something about carbon and oxygen. But she was stricken with a stab of anxiety. Was digging up a beloved pet and macerating its corpse a sign that your child had psychopathic tendencies? Jess tried her best to explain that she'd dug up Milo because she loved him, and that's why she had to see what his skeleton looked like. Beautiful, as she knew it would be. The swoop of the ribcage, the scoop of the eye sockets. Jess loved the interior architecture of living things. Ribs, the protective embrace of them, how they hold delicate organisms in a lifelong hug. Eye sockets. No artisan had ever made a more elegant container for a precious thing. Milo's eyes had been the color of smoky quartz. When Jess touched a finger to the declivities on either side of his delicate skull, she could see those eyes again. The kind gaze of her earliest friend, avid for the next game.
And you paint this great picture of Jess as a kid. There's also in that same chapter where she has a bat, right, that she hangs in her bedroom.
Well, she articulates the skeleton.
Yeah.
And yes, well, you know, I had that bat.
You did? I mean, I actually think bats are quite beautiful.
It's a fruit bat. They're quite large. They look like flying puppies. They're very prevalent in Sydney. And this poor one had been electrocuted. I found it under the electrical wires.
And so, how did you know how to do that?
Well, I didn't really know how to do it. I just waited for nature to take its course.
Yeah, so a lot
the
of
skeleton was beautiful.
Oh, I bet. So Jess is based a little bit on you then.
Yes, I was always going to the tip or the dump, as we call it here, and bringing back ghastly things so I could look at them under my microscope. My mother had 50 fits.
We're talking with Geraldine Brooks. Her new book is Horse. 866-999-4626 if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Geraldine Brooks about her new book, Horse, 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. I love how in the book, Jess gets this job because the other person before her is allergic to the beetle dung, which happens when you have beetles eating or clearing these bones, right?
Yes, they call it frass, which is a polite word for poo. and the predecessor of the lab when I visited just happened to mention that was how she got the job.
So that's true.
That's true. Everything in this book that seems unlikely or weird is the true thing, including the fact that a portrait by this artist was found in a junk pile, which led to the reappraisal of all his work and the first retrospective exhibition of it.
What fun to take kind of all these little grains of truth and then create this great story around them, which, by the way, is a page turner and runs every emotion you can think of. And I kept thinking, okay, and then the next thing happens and the next thing. We're not going to give away any spoilers here today, by the way. So if you call in, no spoilers. Theo and Jess are our current day or 2019 characters. And then we jump back to 1850 Kentucky. And you mentioned this horse racing was very popular during that time period in both the North and South. And interracial, I mean, everybody went.
Yeah, no. So I think, you know, I was very surprised at how unsegregated horse racing was. And my historian husband said, well, yeah, you know, the segregation happened after Reconstruction and was a reaction. Jim Crow was a reaction. But actually, prior to the Civil War, there was a lot more. There were more integrated spaces than there were for the, you know, 100 years that followed. So the track particularly was an integrated space. Everybody was involved in this, and it was also it was integrated by class-wise too, from the elites to the very poor people were all enthusiastic about this. And it makes sense if you think that America in the 1850s and 60s was still a very agrarian society. So most people had a horse, or they're only a generation away from a family that had horses. And people loved to race them. There'd be informal races in the towns. You know, that's how we got the quarter horse, the quarter mile sprint. But the real focus of intense interest were these 4 mile heat races. And if you think about the Kentucky Derby, it's a mile and a quarter. So four times that.
Wow.
And the horses would run that three times in the one day. And there were tremendous rivalries between the thoroughbred breeders to have the best 4 mile horse. This was considered the pinnacle. And I guess the people's enthusiasm, you can measure it in the fact that there were three newspapers devoted entirely to horse racing. So it was very easy for me to research Lexington's career because people were obsessed. He was like a rock star.
Yeah.
You know?
So much of the story in the 1850s centers on Jarrett and his relationship with Lexington. I would imagine researching the lives of the Black horsemen would be difficult. Was there much historical documentation of these trainers, jockeys, and grooms, most of whom were enslaved?
To the extent that their careers were slightly documented, yes, because they were so integral to this thing that the enslavers and the plantation owners were so passionate about. So they would write these letters, and they clearly respected the expertise of these men. They were, of course, all men. And they would write about what their trainer's opinion, and they would defer to it, you know. So Hark says that we should do this and that, you know, Hark being one of the most famous of the Black trainers. And then in the newspapers, the Black jockeys would often be written about, but about their private lives, very little. So we've got maybe one or two sources where somebody talks about in detail about his life. There's an interview with Charles Stewart, which is like an oral history. But it was a white woman taking the oral history, and she was from the family who had formerly enslaved this man. So was he really being frank? Could he say everything he needed to say? So there's so many gaps in the record.
Yeah. Actually, Janet is giving us a call from Martha's Vineyard. Hi, Janet.
Hi, I'm so happy about this program.
Yeah. You have a horse, Janet.
I have one horse, and it's my 13th horse.
Wow.
In my lifetime.
And
I used to have a riding school on Music Street in West Tisbury and taught lower level dressage. But Misty Meadows, my ex husband purchased that farm. He and Bill Honey, who was from the bank in Vineyard Haven, he has since, both of them are deceased. And they started the farm. And they used to do have the cerebral palsy kids come once a week, and they started doing that.
Yeah, that's right.
So I have kind of a long history with horses. I've learned fox hunting, done 100-mile dressage, and all that stuff. But I'm hoping that your guest can come to the West Tisbury Library and give a talk about her book. I've got my name in already for the book.
Oh, good. Janet, I know you will enjoy the book because I know you have a great bond with your horse and probably your past horses.
I do.
Yeah. So, yes, I'm glad
you
got your name.
He's 30 years old right
now. Oh, my goodness. Wow. Well, Janet, thanks for sharing.
He's full of himself.
Yeah.
Janet, where do you keep your horse?
In my yard.
Oh, wonderful. I keep my horse in my yard, too.
Do you?
Yeah, it's just great to be able to spend time.
I've always taken care of my horse. And my feeling is, I mean, they're good boarding stables. However, it's like having children. You're going to notice anything that goes awry or something, and you know you're in charge of their feeding and their blacksmith and all the other stuff that you have to do. And I just enjoy doing that.
Me too.
Yeah. Janet, thanks
and
for the
I'm
call.
I'm 81 now.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm 81.
Well,
I had to stop riding at age 76 because of my hips, although I don't need surgery. But I still love taking care of Skippy. Yeah. And you know what? During the pandemic, I would look out in my yard and people were visiting with my horse. They needed the therapy of this horse.
Yeah, see,
I've got to come and meet Skippy because I just live a block away from Music Street. So
yeah,
Oh, good. Well, I'm not on Music Street anymore. I sold that property. I'm off Old County Road.
Yeah.
Opposite Great Plains Road.
Janet, hang on. I'm gonna have Jenny get your phone number so that we can give it to Geraldine, so she can visit your horse Skippy. Thank you, Janet, for calling and talking about your relationship with Skippy. And maybe Geraldine will be at the library. You never know, right?
You know, the funny thing is that once you get two horse people talking, we'll talk.
I know
all day.
You'll do the rest of the show, right? All right, so let's get back to Jarrett. Tell us about Jarrett, who is a fictional character, but based on real history.
Yes, we know that Jarrett lived, and we know that he was with Lexington, because there is another painting by this artist, Thomas Scott, that was done of Lexington later in life, and it's supposed to be the best painting that Scott ever did, and there are several descriptions of it in quite a lot of detail about how he captured the horse's grandeur but fragility towards the end of his life. And the painting is titled Lexington Being Led Out by quote, Black Jarrett, his groom. Mm. So I immediately wanted to find out more about that person's life. And he's in the record, but only in terms of after the Emancipation Proclamation. The farm owner started paying him, so he's in there with records of being paid, but we don't know anything really more about him. Mm-hmm. So I had to make him up as a composite of trainers and grooms that we do know something about.
You want to read a little bit about Jarrett?
Yeah, this is when Lexington is about to be foaled. Warfield's Jarrett, The Meadows, Lexington, Kentucky, 1850. She was no one's notion of an easy mare, not mean, but nervous, which could come to the same thing if you didn't account for it. Jarrett knew how to approach her, steady and deliberate. You shouldn't hesitate or show uncertainty. But if you were too high-handed, she'd make you pay. She could snake around and have a piece of your arm, or kick out and crack a shin. Dr. Elisha Warfield had bred her himself and named her for his daughter-in-law, Alice Carneal. There were jokes around the barn about what he meant by that and what he might have been trying to say to his son. But Alice Carneal never hurt Jarrett. No horse ever had. "Look at him," Dr. Warfield would say, lifting one of Jarrett's long, skinny arms. "He's half colt himself." Jarrett took it as a compliment, for what would be the use in taking it otherwise? And it was true he had a feel for horses, deep in the grain. The first bed he could remember was in a horse stall. He shared straw with the two geldings in the carriage house while his mother slept in the mansion, nursemaid to a little white boy. Jarrett barely saw her. His first language had been the subtle gestures and sounds of horses. He'd been slow to master human speech, but he could interpret the horses, their moods, their alliances, their simple wants, their many fears. He came to believe that horses lived with a world of fear, and when you grasp that, you had a clear idea how to be with them.
Mm. And you mentioned this idea of you know, the prey versus predator. And Jarrett really saw things from the horse's point of view.
That's right. Well, you know, I've actually given all my feelings and experiences with horses to Jarrett. So it's very personal how he responds to them. But there have always been some people who understood this, and it goes right back to Xenophon, who wrote a wonderful treatise on horsemanship that is still, you know, absolutely actionable information about how to choose and train a good horse, and his emphasis is on kind treatment. Mm-hmm. And you're reading it, and it seems so contemporary, and then he gets up to the bit where he tells you how to use your javelin to mount your horse, and you realize that this is a guy who went to school with Socrates.
So the story is also a testament to that bond people have with animals. Jarrett has I think he probably has a stronger bond with Lexington than any human.
I think that is true. It's until quite late in the book. It is the defining relationship of his life.
Yeah. We get a window into the racing world, which isn't pretty on many levels. There's the racism, of course. Also, how disposable the horses were once they were considered no longer of any use, you know, be it racing or producing the next generation of great horses. And it got me thinking about the treatment of horses then and now.
Well, it's more true today than it was then. I mean, I think racing has so many issues regarding animal welfare because back in the 1850s, if a horse didn't make it as a racehorse, there are a million other uses that that horse could be put to. And also, they weren't pumping them full of drugs to make their bones grow quicker, and they weren't riding them as two-year-olds. You know, anyone who is with horses understands that you really shouldn't be riding them extensively till they're five. But at five, most contemporary racehorses have already finished their career and quite disposable because some of them can't be retrained easily for anything else.
Yeah. I was thinking years ago, I did a story in Maine with this group that had a sanctuary for horses. They would take them in and adopt. And I think all the horses cost the same thing. I think it was, I want to say $500, but whatever it was, they all had the same number. And the day I was there, there was this absolutely beautiful horse. Fresca was the horse's name. And it had fallen at the track. And so the owner said, not going to be good anymore. But so he gave this horse to be adopted out. And boy, that horse just had so much personality. I wanted to take it home in the worst way. But I don't know that we see that much. And a lot of times they're just put down, right?
It's terrible, yeah. And you know, a lot of cruelty even with that, because they're exported to Mexico to be slaughtered, which is a terrible journey for a horse to have to make. But, you know, my horse Valentine's pasture mate is an off-the-track racehorse called Screaming Hot Wings.
I love the name.
And he is 33 years old.
Oh, wow.
So when you look at a horse like that, who has been, of course, incredibly well-treated. Jean, his mom, loves that horse. She says it's the longest relationship of her life. But he's got so much to give. He's still sound and rideable, and he even still likes to jump if he gets the chance to do it.
Yeah. Some of the characters in your book were real people. Photographers Thomas Scott, for one, the art collector you mentioned, and dealer Martha Jackson, Mary, there's so many characters. I'm wondering how you handle those characters. They need to weave into your story, but they existed in real life. So how true to who they really were do you stay or even know, or is it more fictionalized than
so you? I like to, because I believe what Mark Twain said. He said, fiction is required to stick to possibilities. Truth isn't. So I think you're a fool as a novelist if you don't mind the truth, because the truth will be more fabulous than anything you're allowed to make up.
Right.
So I try and keep it close, but if I can't know something, then I take some liberties. Some things are suggested, you know. So Thomas Scott, the painter, was a fascinating guy. He started out, wanted to be a doctor, but couldn't afford the tuition, which is still unfortunately true today. Mm-hmm. So he became a pharmacist, but then his true love was horses and painting horses and writing about horses. And he was an itinerant artist. And then when the Civil War happened, he was a volunteer on the Union side for Kentucky. And because of his medical training, he became the medic for his unit. So he had a very interesting Civil War story as well. And so, you know, I've stuck to his biography, but then there are certain things that are interesting about it. He had a very late marriage, but he didn't live with his wife for very long. And so that suggested to me, you know, that he may have had other relationships. Mm-hmm. And so I went there.
you dedicate the book to your late husband, writer Tony Horowitz. And you write in your afterword that you traveled together to Kentucky, where your research often intersected in intriguing ways.
It was fantastic because we hadn't had an experience of books with overlapping characters before. But he was writing a book called Spying on the South about the young exploits of Frederick Law Olmsted, who went on to design Central Park. But he got the idea for what parks could be from his travels around the South as a reporter for the New York Times, which was a very new newspaper in those days. And they had sent him to investigate the great divisions in American society prior to the Civil War. And Tony was following in his footsteps, investigating the very great divisions in the country that happened in the run-up to President Trump's election. And so it was very much the same story of why is our country coming apart. But while we were in Kentucky, several of the people that Olmsted had met and written about in his reports and in his journals were people who were involved with Lexington as well. So we were able to do some research together. And of course, he being a real historian was able to help me enormously in plumbing the archives for relevant material.
Yeah. You also thank your son, Vito, and some of your friends of color who gave you their insights into the modern Black experience, right?
Yes. Well, that was crucial to me that I should listen, you know, very hard, and I'm just very grateful because there's nothing more tiring, I think, for Black people than having to explain racism. There are, you know, whites own racism back to a white person, but, you know, people were very generous with their time and their insights, and so they helped me shape the modern character of Theo.
Well, yeah, which is very helpful in shaping Theo's experience. But where did you turn for the information into the experience, the Black experience in the 1850s? Was that archives?
Yeah, that no, then I rested on the work of really serious historians. Wonderful work has been done on the Black jockeys by historians. And Bill Cook at the International Museum of the Horse, even as I was writing, was unearthing more and more information on them. And also then social histories like Tara Hunter's fantastic book about enslaved marriage called Bound in Wedlock, where she looks at her own family's history in that regard and then widens the lens to look at the variety of and the precarity of relationships under the slavery institution and how families could be torn apart and how precarious love and marriage was.
A couple of other real characters in the book, Cassius Clay. Wait a second, I know that name. Muhammad Ali took that name. But
Muhammad Ali
had that name.
And it's possible that his father had worked for the Clay family, which, of course, a big family in Kentucky and very important in the politics around the Civil War. But Cassius Clay was an ardent emancipationist. He freed all the slaves that he inherited. And then he had a newspaper called The True American, which was an emancipationist newspaper that led to three assassination attempts on him. None of them were successful because he was a fierce fighter, and he would fight off people coming at him with guns with a Bowie knife.
Wow. And then his daughter Mary. Tell us a little about Mary.
So Cassius Clay was married to the daughter of the doctor who bred Lexington. Mary Jane Warfield was a fantastically accomplished woman. Cassius Clay ended up going to Russia during the Civil War as the ambassador on Lincoln's behalf to the Tsar. And while he was away in Russia, she ran the big family estate and very shrewdly and profitably and completely renovated the family mansion. And then he came back and he'd been having an affair with a Russian ballerina, so she sent him to sleep in the unheated attic. And the marriage failed. And her daughter Mary Barclay saw the injustice of the system when her parents divorced. Mary Jane was left with absolutely nothing. She had no rights to any of the marital property. So Mary Barr became an ardent feminist and fighter for women's suffrage.
And Mary and Jared have this friendship in the book. And talk about that, because every time Mary comes to see Jared, I'm getting nervous.
Well, yeah, because, you know, we all know how many Black men were lynched because they were perceived to look the wrong way at a white woman. And So Mary Barr is a little oblivious about this because she's younger than Jarrett, and he taught her to ride, and she's just living her white privilege, and she doesn't understand as she grows up what precarious position, what she perceives as a friendship, what he perceives as something completely different and a little dangerous to him.
Yeah.
So he's always trying to fend her off and trying to get her to behave in a more safe way.
Yeah. We mentioned that Lexington was the most successful sire of the late 19th century. So the numbers were unbelievable, right?
Yes. Well, he led the stud sire record for 16 years. His progeny won more races than any other horse, and that's phenomenal. And it would have been even more if the Civil War hadn't intervened, because a lot of horses, there was no racing during those years, of course, and a lot of horses were taken to be army cavalry mounts, including a horse called Cincinnati, who was a son of Lexington, who was General Grant's horse.
And wasn't Preakness in the line?
Preakness was a son of Lexington also. And, of course, four other winners of the Preakness, which was named after that horse. And then, of course, Aristides, which was the first winner of the Kentucky Derby, was a son of Lexington, trained by a black trainer, Ansel Williams, who had been formerly enslaved, and ridden to success by a black jockey.
Yeah. And so we have these enslaved black people who are really key to this industry, right? And then Civil War comes, and then after, they're shut out.
Yeah, no, that was a... You know, it's a tragic story. Some of these jockeys who were lauded before the Civil War, after they faced such opposition from white jockeys, and there's almost a conspiracy to push them off the track, and sometimes their lives are put in danger in races, and they can't get mounts. And some of the most famous ones had to go abroad to continue their work, and others just died penniless.
Oh, so sad. Are you working on, have you started an idea for the next book? I mean, because this is what, your sixth historical fiction, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I will be starting another one, but I had another project which I've just finished, which is nonfiction.
Okay.
And that'll be coming out at the end of this year. And so, yeah, I've been trying to keep busy.
Can you tell us what the nonfiction is about?
It's about an Australian author. It's for a series of books where one Australian writer appreciates the work of another one, and it's my favorite Australian writer, Tim Winton.
Yeah, so you're switching hats, fiction, nonfiction, kind of back and forth. Well, it's lovely to get lost in your historical fiction, and you know, you're one of my favorite writers. I love all of your books, and it was a page turner. I couldn't put it down, and really very insightful. So really appreciate you being in studio with me this morning. Geraldine Brooks, her new book is Horse, and we will have a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Thanks for coming in, Geraldine. Appreciate
Thank you
that.
For having me, Mindy.
Coming up next, a tribute to a current day racehorse. Stay with us. You're listening to The Point. Up next, a love letter to the American thoroughbred Zenyatta, a record-breaking, charismatic superhorse who captured the hearts of horse lovers and racing fans everywhere in 2009 and 2010. Here's Julie Shapiro.
Dear Z, it's late, but I've had it on my mind to write to you for weeks, and with the snow falling steadily outside, Nathaniel at band practice for another hour, it's the perfect time to start a letter. I still remember the exact moment I met you, about 15 months ago, when an email from my dear mother-in-law popped into my inbox with a link to a news article she thought I'd find interesting. Given my textbook horse girl identity growing up, including those 12 years spent competing at shows across the country almost every weekend, rain or shine, people forward me horsey stuff all the time. I don't usually dig into those links because I've mostly put the horse world behind me. I've moved on in my life, mostly. So who knows what compelled me to read that article, having ignored so many others? What I do know is that I was immediately hooked, call it love at first sight, and spent the hours afterward clicking on links, reading more articles, and watching videos all about you, including that unbelievable one.
Zenyatta coming flying on the grandstand side, Gio Ponti on the inside, Summerbird is right there. This is unbelievable! Zenyatta! What a performance, one we'll never forget. Looked impossible.
So you first showed up on my radar that night, but by that time you were already a proven champ. 14 races entered, 14 wins. Zenyatta, you were unbeatable. I kept reading and learned about your past, how you were born all legs in Kentucky, a big brown filly with a white blaze on your face and two white socks on your back legs. How as a yearling, you were bought for a pittance, well, by industry standards, by the founder of a major rock and roll label. How he named you Zenyatta after a song by one of the bands in his stable and moved you out to California. And how you didn't even start racing until way into your third year. I guess that's a pretty late start for a racehorse, but you definitely made up for lost time, usually with your good friend Mike Smith in the saddle, decked out in those sassy pink and teal silks. At 17.2 hands, you were way taller than most of the boys you kept beating, bigger than most horses that ever stepped foot on a racetrack. But above all, it was your incredible personality that set you apart from the others. You were gentle and playful and loved posing for the camera. And then there was that dancing thing you did on your way to the starting gate every single time.
Zenyatta, look what she's doing with her front right there, Randy. This is patented Zenyatta, and we'll talk about this a little later on, these dance moves that she goes through.
Plus, you had that funny habit of breaking out of the gate last in every race.
Zenyatta, a little slow to get going.
And the bad start has Zenyatta at the back of the pack.
Zenyatta is dead last. Zenyatta's dead last early.
And staying back there until it seemed simply not possible for you to get to the finish line first.
Zenyatta is still last, got to be a good 12 off this lead.
Except that you always managed to get there first. And man, did those announcers lose it when you did.
And Zenyatta just making it look all too easy. This is simply poetry in motion.
How do you describe perfection? Why try? Let's just watch her run. This is Zenyatta.
Zenyatta's kicked into gear, and here she comes, right on by. Zenyatta suddenly two in front. Here's the real Zen Master, and she's 1-11.
Just another perfect day for the Queen, Zenyatta!
Zenyatta, you just kept racing and winning. I know because I started following your every move, your every race, your every Facebook post, along with your legions of fans around the world. So I remember when you got voted the second best female athlete of 2009 by the Associated Press, runner-up to Serena Williams. Not bad. And when that video of you drinking a Guinness out of a Tupperware container was making the rounds.
Zenyatta enjoying her Guinness this morning after a nice little gallop.
In March 2010, you won your 15th race, and a few months later, your 16th. And then in June, I watched your 17th race from a hotel in Dublin. It was a balmy afternoon in California where you were running, and a cold and rainy early morning in Ireland where I was glued to my laptop. And I pretty much screamed at the top of my lungs along with the announcer as you zoomed up from last place to win the race.
Stamp this day in your minds and hearts. The Queen continues her legend 17 in a row.
I did apologize for the noise at the front desk the next morning, but I think by then I'd crossed a line. Case in point, one night a few weeks later, I came home a little tipsy from a show and bought a $43 t-shirt with a crappy iron-on illustration of you. And it's true, all I really wanted for my birthday was a plastic briar model of you, which I was lucky to even get because those sold out fast. In August, you won your 18th straight race, and then in early October, your 19th. At this point, you'd broken so many records. Dubbed the Queen of Racing, you'd become a superheroine to people all over the world. Even 60 Minutes caught the Zenyatta bug.
Next Saturday, she could become the first great American athlete to retire undefeated in more than half a century.
Then, last November, you flew east to Kentucky to run in the 2010 Breeders' Cup Classic against a daunting field of 11 other horses, all boys. This was to be your last race ever and could extend your record to an unbelievable 20 straight wins. There was so much at stake, so much pressure from all the experts and pundits and racing know-it-alls.
The stakes are extremely high, and not just in millions of dollars.
I was really nervous for you in the days leading up to that race.
Zenyatta is so adored by horse lovers that if she doesn't beat the boys and win one last time, hearts will be broken everywhere.
The story will continue in a moment.
I wanted to watch the Breeders' Cup in real time, but found myself at a good friend's wedding in downtown Chicago right at post time.
The roar from the Churchill Downs, proud as the field is sent on their way, and Zenyatta is dead last.
I tried my best to pay attention to the ceremony, but was all too aware that you were galloping as fast as you could right around the time the children's choir was shouting its way through Bicycle Built for Two, with the bride's name switched in for Daisy.
Second, Fly Down was third, and Looking at Lucky finished fourth. Well, there we have it. Ahead will separate.
After the ceremony, while hors d'oeuvres were passed and champagne was poured, I checked my phone, discreetly, of course. And this was how I discovered that you'd lost, as they say, by a nose to blame. Everyone said you ran like a champion, but I actually could not bring myself to watch that race until I sat down to write this letter. Even 2.5 months later, knowing the outcome, it still made me cry. So, Zenyatta, you finished your career with a still dazzling 19-1 record. And there's no doubt you've left your mark on the history of horse racing, which I'll probably go back to not paying much attention to. But I will continue to follow what you're up to. A quick check-in at Zenyatta.com confirms that you're now happily retired back in Kentucky at Lane's End Farm. I imagine it won't be long before they start breeding you. People can't wait to see your babies. And I like picturing you there, grazing in an enormous green pasture surrounded by pristine white fencing, your sides heavy with foal. Maybe you're thinking back fondly on some of your most exciting victories and the roar of the crowd. Or maybe that "So Bad It's Almost Good" country song written about you is stuck in your head. And Lexington's not that far away, perfect road trip distance, in fact. Maybe I'll find my way down there soon, with an armful of carrots and a six-pack of Guinness. Your friend, Julie.
Zenyatta arrives, you feel the crowd swell. Zenyatta, Zenyatta, you hear the crowd yell. Zenyatta, Zenyatta, hear everyone say, we love you, Zenyatta, and good luck today. Zenyatta knows it's all about her, so she points her toes, she busts out her best moves, and she gets down low. Yeah, the big mama knows how to put on the show. Zenyatta, she's gonna be last from the gate. She'll be last at the half, last at the 3/8. She's last at the quarter, she's not gonna lose. No, she's checking with Mike about what gear to use. Zenyatta, Zenyatta, the other jocks say, you think you're alive, she'll just blow you.
That was Third Coast Artistic Director Julie Shapiro with a love letter to the American thoroughbred Zenyatta. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.